Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Well, the Federal Reserve is about to raise interest rates again to battle inflation just days before a midterm election. Elon Musk has fired another bunch of people. And we have a midterm election coming up, both in Vermont and around the country. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint at WDEV Radio. I'm Kevin Ellis, your host, and let's get right to it. Our guest today in the first hour is political consultant Julia Barnes. She's going to help us explore the upcoming elections because she has a unique perspective both on the national scene and the local. In our second hour, we will hear from the Vermont candidates for Secretary of State, Sarah Copeland Hansis for the Democrats and H. Brooke Page for Republicans. They will both be in studio. But first, let's get to Julia Barnes, who has worked in progressive politics for a long time. She served in statewide gubernatorial and presidential campaigns. She has worked for President Joe Biden. She worked for Barack Obama. She was national field director for Bernie Sanders in 2016 on his presidential campaign, including being state director for Bernie in New Hampshire, helping him win the New Hampshire primary. She's currently serves as the CEO of the Movement Cooperative, a company dedicated to providing shared data and tech solutions to progressive organizations. She lives in Burlington, and she has an MBA from the University of Vermont. And she served as the executive director of the Vermont Democratic Party for 4 years and oversaw that operation through two successful election cycles. Welcome, Julia Barnes.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. It's good to have you on.
Thanks.
I have to admit that I called a Republican friend before we got on, and I said, tell me what's going on out there. And she said, and this is one of those old-fashioned moderate Vermont Republicans from yesteryear. And she said, Maggie Hassan's going to go down in New Hampshire. The Republicans are going to take over the Senate, the United States Senate, and they're going to have 62 seats. So, which raises the question where I want to start with you. You are a deeply expert person in progressive politics across the board, nationally and in Vermont. Here's my question, and then we can just riff for the next hour. If the Republicans do in fact take over the United States Senate, put Vermont aside for the moment, despite the fact that there are two, and I'm going to make this argument, two weak candidates for the Republicans in Pennsylvania and Georgia, in with Dr. Oz and Herschel Walker, but those were put forward by Trump. If the Republicans had put more moderate Republican candidates forward in those states, aren't we looking at a – same in New Hampshire – aren't we asking ourselves the question on Wednesday morning, what happened to the Democratic Party? Why is their message not working?
Yeah. First of all, I have to just say I can't imagine there's any version of the future in which Republicans get to 62 seats in the Senate, but
okay, good.
You know, magic math aside, we are looking at what could potentially be a very difficult midterm election. This is not an unusual dynamic. A lot of sitting presidents have tough midterms, but outside of the sort of pattern of history when it comes to our federal level elections, we are existing in an increasingly volatile and dramatic sort of partisan ideology as it comes to our politics. I think that there are two sides to the to the hypothetical of what would have happened if Republicans had run some more moderate candidates in some of these races.
Right.
The one side is, you know, I think that they would be, we would be seeing these, we would be seeing a more moderate candidate in Georgia, potentially present a more cohesive vision for the state. And certainly Reverend Warnock would have to engage in more deep debate about substantial issues as opposed to, you know, litigate whether or not his opponent is actually a sheriff.
Right.
But do I think that that reality would be possible? I don't know. I think that we are seeing a national Republican Party where the ability to field what would have been traditionally credible candidates is becoming more and more difficult as the party becomes more and more extreme. We're talking about a Republican Party these days where 70% of identified Republican voters don't believe that Joe Biden is the legitimate president. There is a new reality that's happening for the right in this country. And I think that, you know, for me personally, for my friends who work on the left, I think we are still working through this sort of intellectual challenge of believing that that is actually true, that there is a growing cohort in this country that that believes that the election was stolen, that believes in the misogyny and homophobia and racism of Trump and his acolytes, and so I think that there is a real conversation that needs to be had after this midterm about what sort of fronts are we fighting these partisan battles on, right?
Yeah.
Traditional campaigns where we are canvassing door to door, where we're phone banking, where we're trying to activate, engage volunteers. Those spaces aren't the places where political conversations are happening anymore. They're happening on social media. They're happening on sort of these unregulated platforms where a version of the truth is never actually presented objectively, right?
Yeah.
I joke a lot that if, you know, anybody who runs my single issue voter identification these days is like, give me a candidate who is going to promise to regulate as hard as they possibly can our social media platforms and, you know, support real consequences for the spread of disinformation in this country, because we are not running our elections. We're not seeing midterms particularly like exist in a dynamic of objective truth anymore.
I mean, the record will show. Let's see. I think let's call it a guaranteed lock that the U.S. House of Representatives already. The majority of the Republican Party in the U.S. House voted, is on the record, to overturn the presidential election of Joe Biden. And that will likely only increase after Tuesday. So this is not theoretical. You're making a great point. This is where the Republican Party is headed, and it therefore candidates like Herschel Walker, Dr. Oz, Mr. Bolduc in New Hampshire, that's going to be the norm going forward. And so, you know, there's a lot of sort of older generation voters like me who say, oh, wouldn't it be great to have a return to the good old days of the moderate Republicans in Vermont, the George Akins, the Jim Douglases, the Phil Scotts. But Vermont is increasingly looking like an outlier and to the rest of the country.
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's almost like our sort of in-state politics and even our federal politics are almost the exact inverse of what's happening nationally. There is, you know, my mother is the same way, still expresses disbelief at the loss of the moderate Republican. My dad was a guy who for his whole life considered himself, you know, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. Those folks are not the engaged majority in the Republican Party anymore. You know, it started with the Tea Party. It was somebody poured jet fuel on that fire with Donald Trump. We are talking about a party in this country that is like fundamentally based in disreality and in a political agenda that is that seeks to divide us more than unite us, that wants to make sure that like corporations and the top 1% can continue to thrive in this country while it gets harder and harder for middle class and working class Americans. And, you know, they're doing it all by stoking the fires of all of the divisions you could imagine in our country. And, you know, it is for us to continue, for Democrats to continue, for, you know, generations in our country to continue to believe that this is an outlier, that this is a temporary situation. It's not. This is what the Republican Party is these days. And you're right. It's going to get worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're at the beginning here. Julia, before the break, we talked about the break-in at Nancy Pelosi's house in San Francisco. It's her husband, just to recap, she was not there. She is the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, second in line to the presidency. Her husband was there. He fought off the attacker, battled over a hammer, and the attacker attacked him with the hammer, and he fractured his skull. He is recovering in the hospital. This was clearly an attack, as the attacker has told police, at the very least, fueled by conspiracy theories and an attempt to, quote, break her kneecaps and bring her back to Washington to face questioning. Obviously, this is craziness, and it's a very, very dark, dark issue that we have to discuss on the air. However, I think we've got to discuss it. What's your take on this?
I mean, first and foremost, absolutely disgusting. We should universally, regardless of, you know, party identity or politics, be able to say objectively that this type of political violence is abhorrent just at face value. But I think that there are really, you know, looking at sort of the dynamics here, I think that there are two levels where this is beyond just problematic on face value. The first is that what really struck me about the coverage of this incident was we first got this very sort of tepid line from middle of the road or more middle of the road Republicans. You know, everybody sort of gives the thoughts and prayers, the same thoughts and prayers sentiment that they give during when responding to mass shootings and then move on. But the truth is that Speaker Pelosi and, you know, Democrats, particularly women members of color in the House, folks have been under an increased level of threat of violence for quite some time. We're talking about folks serving in our representative body who are doing so under the constant threat and increasingly vocal threat and increasingly vocal in the public narrative and public media threat of violence. And to see it executed in this way and then responded to as tepidly as it was from the right was a reaffirmation of how disconnected from reality this party is. The second thing that was interesting in the coverage was very quickly we sort of moved away from, on the right at least, moved away from the tepid thoughts and prayers narrative to a doubling down of the conspiracy theories. And you really see that for two reasons. One is that obviously, like as we've discussed, the GOP has really embraced a lot of the unbridled fallacies of the internet as their sort of mainstream policy platform. But also, there was an incident which Elon Musk tweeted a conspiracy theory in response to a very sort of objective and direct condemnation of the violence by Hillary Clinton. And it's not that he necessarily believes that conspiracy theory. It's that the man just bought Twitter and wants to stoke engagement and, you know, sort of like stoke the drama. And it's very much, I think, something that we saw with the early parts of the Trump campaign, where activating these moments of real human suffering as a performative entertainment and engagement tactic is disgusting on a moral level, but it is also like manipulative to all of the Americans who are really buying into all of this conspiracy theory. It astonishes me that folks who would believe those types of lies, would believe in things like QAnon, don't see that these people in power are using them and attempting to take these moments where, you know, in real life, if we were in space with Paul Pelosi, anybody, regardless of their partisan affiliation, would feel so much empathy and care for him as another human for just having been attacked in this like violent way. But in these silos that we are living our lives from the pandemic, from the internet, whatever it is, these individuals, folks who are looking to capitalize off of this violence and this hatred, are using these moments to try to make, to give themselves more power, to try to make themselves richer. It is really challenging to sit through and watch these patterns unfold. And the last thing I'll say about this is, like, this isn't also new, right? The sort of service under the threat of violence has been going on for quite some time. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been sexually harassed by colleagues. Representative Ilhan Omar is constantly under threat of physical harm. She's had multiple death threats. She's had her colleagues in the House, including that horrible woman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, actually like profess violence towards her. Folks have been stalked. Women and minorities who are serving in public office have been stalked and threatened. And we're starting to exist in a space where the threat of violence is becoming more normalized. But the response that our institutions are having to that violence is not catching up. And my concern in all of this is, like, while we sort of hit this crux of tension in our ideological grievances, whether imagined or otherwise, we are dehumanizing each other in our political system because of this type of violence. And I worry about what will happen to the quality and dedication of the people that we are electing to office if the experience that they have stepping into public service and civil service is to put them and their families at risk. It's challenging.
Yeah, that's a very good point. When we had Maggie Haberman from the New York Times on the show last week, I asked her and she about the question that I ask a lot of people that is also very dark and hard to contemplate, but I think we need to ask it anyway. If on January 6th, those rioters had found Vice President Mike Pence.
Oh God.
And yeah. What if they had found Speaker Pelosi? What would they have done with them? The threat was that they were going to kill them. I don't see that discussed in the media. I think we're all trying to be responsible about these subjects. We don't want to fuel this behavior. But I think we have to ask ourselves as responsible citizens what might have happened so that, as you say, you know, the rest of us are not catching up to what's really going on. If Pelosi had been home in San Francisco when that break-in had happened, Lord knows what might have happened.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Speaker Pelosi is not, you know, she's not a young woman. She is using, you know, she's using her life, the extent of her life, to be in civil service. And it's scary to me even thinking about, you know, she's older than my mom, but thinking about my mother in a situation like that, I can't. Yeah. Like, it makes me feel nauseated. I don't think anybody can look at the footage from January 6th, the testimony from the committee hearings, you know, sort of public comment by folks who were there at the Capitol, and honestly believe that if that mob had not found or had found Vice President Pence or Speaker Pelosi, that there wouldn't have, that somebody wouldn't have died. Another, like a elected leader in this country wouldn't have died or been seriously harmed.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, objectively, look, political violence globally is not anything new, but it is becoming so consistently normalized in the way that our partisan politics is happening these days that it almost doesn't feel remarkable. And I think it's that lack of shock at it that is also making it hard for us to deal with it, right? Like I have friends who worked who work on the Hill, who work in offices, who that January 6th was something they will be dealing with in terms of their PTSD for the rest of their lives. These are normal people. There are thousands of normal people that work at the Capitol.
Well, most of them very young. Most of them very young.
Extremely. Great. Yeah. Yes, you know, your daughter is on the Hill too.
Yeah. Full disclosure, my daughter works for Bernie Sanders. Full disclosure.
Yeah. Freeland is great. You should be very proud, as I know you are.
But these are young people. They are the future of the country, of Republicans and Democrats, and it's a frightening state.
Well, that's my point. What outside of the violence of the moment, what types of people are going to want to show up and do those jobs in the long run if we don't figure out how to cut through all of this sort of dehumanization and normalized violence and see each other again as people trying to, you know, work on actual legislation, complex actual legislation to help people.
Well, we're going to try to keep doing it on this show. Our guest is Julia Barnes. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and we'll be back on the other side. We're going to start getting into Vermont elections. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back. I'm Kevin Ellis. It's Vermont Viewpoint. Our guest is Julia Barnes, a political consultant. In Vermont and all over the country, you can reach us at 244-1777, 244-1777. We'd love to take your calls, especially Brian from Eden, who we had a great conversation with the last time. I think we were talking about farm milk prices and small farms. Julia, before the break, you mentioned what we all know, which is the pattern of elections in this country. The incumbent president, the sitting president, is usually unpopular, and at the midterms, the party in power loses seats. Biden is very unpopular. Interest rates are going up to battle inflation. The price of gas is still high, and Biden, I believe today, is on his way to Oregon, of all places, to campaign for candidates. Mm-hmm. If Democrats are going to lose seats in Oregon, it's going to be a bleak Tuesday night. Take us inside the White House and tell us what Chief of Staff Ron Klain and the president are looking at in terms of a map.
Yeah, I mean, I think the map is challenging. Certainly, we are looking at a midterm election where a couple of things are happening. The first is, like I sort of have alluded to earlier in our conversation, there is a disconnect happening between what traditional political engagement has looked like and what political engagement is looking like in the reality of America. And so, yeah, the president should travel to places to shore up important races. Oregon, outside of its relevancy as a liberal state has a really important governor's race happening and also has the opportunity to send send some great folks to Congress. So I'm glad he's campaigning there. But they're also going to the places that you and I know matter. He is in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Nevada. They are hitting these battleground states, and I don't think they're taking anything for granted. It is a challenging. I can't imagine the depth of challenge coming into the presidency after the true chaos and disaster of President Trump. But outside of that, I think that they're doing everything that they can in smart ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, there is still a possibility we get out of Tuesday. Maintaining the Senate, protecting some important governor's races. And also, we are going to send some really great people to the House. It's going to be a hard freshman year, but U.S. House has always been more sort of politically volatile than any other body in our government. So.
Well, let's on that note, let's veer to Vermont. Which I don't know whether you use the term outlier or aberration or what, but we are on the verge of sending, let's see, the first gay woman to Congress in Becca mm-hmm. Ballant, barring miracle upsets. We are going to send elect most likely a gay man to be the state treasurer in Mike Pichak, who we had on the show the other day. We're going to have a little mini debate for Secretary of State between Sarah Copeland Hanzus and Brooke Page later in the show. You have to say that Copeland Hanzus is favored to win that race. It is a bleak place Vermont is these days for Republicans. And I guess my first question is, why, given the rest of the country?
I mean, we could spend the whole hour on just this
right.
topic alone, Kevin. First, I would be remiss to not say how deeply excited I am and just so like wholeheartedly happy that we are sending Becca Ballant to Washington. I have not met a public servant as dedicated, as kind, as resilient, as Senator Ballant, and she is going to do a truly exceptional job for Vermonters. But I think that her general election race really speaks to why the Republican Party is so weak in Vermont. Her opponent, who recently has, publicly admitted to, campaign finance violations, has not embraced the support of the Vermont GOP, is at odds with the Vermont GOP. They have fielded fringe candidates across the board, with the exception of Governor Scott, and that's not a new pattern.
Right. No, it's not.
Even when I was running the Vermont Democratic Party 10 years ago, I would say at that time the Vermont GOP was about as well organized as it's ever been. But we're not talking about a party that puts resources, a national party. I mean, the National Republican Party doesn't put resources into developing their state parties, developing their bench in some of these places. And because the Vermont GOP has been underfunded, radicalized, far, far right, they don't have a center for which to pull talented and capable public servants into their field. This election for Vermont is going to see the ascent of a slate of extraordinary public servants and Democrats who are going to, I believe, go on to have very long careers serving the state, and there are a lot of factors that made that happen. The, you know, VDP has been organized and funded and worked very hard to support these candidates. They invest in local infrastructure for their political operations. The candidates are, you know, sending a message that resonate with Vermonters. We're lucky to live in a state that is small enough where if you have questions about your candidates, you don't have to rely on television ads or the internet exclusively to get the answers. You can literally go meet them at a local fair or, you know, in a lot of cases, call them on the phone.
Or they show up to your door.
Yeah, or they show up to your door. I mean, that level of connectedness is absolutely a boon for us in Vermont, where it's not necessarily a factor in other parts of the country. And I do personally believe we see the impact of that in the way that our politics manifests, as opposed to the national trends.
One more question about Becca Ballant, I believe you advised during the campaign in a hard-fought primary race with fellow Democrat Molly Gray, the sitting lieutenant governor, whom burst onto the scene 2 years ago and won the lieutenant governor's office in convincing fashion. And then Becca Ballant, who serves as president of the Vermont Senate, announces her intention to run and wins that race against Molly Gray convincingly. I guess my question is, does the Ballant win over Molly Gray say something broader about the Vermont electorate, or was it just a candidate who ran a great race? Obviously, there were allegations going back and forth. There was the crypto billionaire who dumped a lot of money in the race. Some people say that didn't have an effect. There's the Bernie endorsement of Becca Ballant. There's all sorts of, you know, and there's still a lot of bitterness, I think, that goes back and forth. Does it say something larger about the electorate, or was it just a candidate who did a really good job?
I mean, the first thing I'll say is that, you know, just objectively, Becca won this race on her merit. She won this race on the credibility of her ideas, of her character, and of the strength of her campaign. You don't win a 23-point victory without that. So I know that there is probably folks who don't believe that, but I can tell you objectively, outside spending did not impact the outcome of this race, that's for sure. So what I think it says is, it's two things. One, I think there is certainly a difference to how many Vermont campaigns are run as opposed to places in the country where politics has to be more competitive, more professional, more consistent, right? We have not had an arguably competitive primary for really any seat on the left since 2010. And so I think one of the things that the Ballant campaign did is they ran a really competitive, modern campaign that included everything from getting Becca out on the road constantly in all of the places that she needed to be, but they ran smart comms. They used their resources incredibly well. They hired a really great organizing team that got out there and engaged people, and they really used the enthusiasm of the Ballant supporters to put votes on the board, to like get the metrics they needed to know that when it came down to GOTV time, they were going to be able to turn out enough voters to win.
Yep.
And so across the board, I would say, Becca ran a campaign that in any other state where politics is more competitive would have been just as good and just as successful. The second thing that I think it says is I don't think it says anything particularly new about the Vermont electorate. This is a state where people believe in the individual, and they buy into the vision of the individual and their contributions to service. And, you know, I think people were really enervated by Becca's track record of serving her community, serving the state, creating real coalitions. They understand that despite the fact that Becca is very progressive, she is, you know, not a ideologue. She's a common sense coalition builder who fights deeply for her values. And that is what, that's what people are looking for. I think there was also, I think Lieutenant Governor Gray has served extremely well as our Lieutenant Governor. I think she has a bright future in service for Vermont. I hope to see her continue to do it. I think this was just not her election. I think, you know, I think people were looking for someone who had more hope.
Yeah, interesting.
In times that feel really dark.
Julia, I got to ask you before we get to the lightning round. Phil Scott.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain his popularity?
I mean,
he's really popular.
Yes, he is. So, look, I explain it with two things. One, the power of incumbency in Vermont is extraordinary. You know, we put deep faith and belief in our elected officials, and forestalling deep conspiracy despite the fact that, like, he hasn't necessarily done anything particularly scandalous,
right.
I think people will continue to feel good about Phil Scott. But, I mean, the other side of it is that, like, he has been very vocal about playing sort of the very edge of his identity as a national Republican figure. You know, he picks, I think, some strategic opportunities to disavow himself from the national party and from Trump particularly.
Yes.
I think at face value, people appreciate that. I mean, I think that there's like a darker challenge to that, which is, you know, Governor Scott is a Republican. He does identify with the party. He is out there, particularly in this election, supporting and being being sort of used as a sometimes, I guess, non-complacent validator for some really extreme Republicans. And, you know, there's only so many times a person can be like, oh, well, I don't actually know these people. I don't actually hang out with them,
right,
before it sort of strains credibility, right? Yeah, so that's what I think.
Yeah, he's done very well what governors always do, which is, as a former executive director of the party, you know well, which is they go out and they build their own brand. They try to ignore the party as best, not as best they can, but they, you know, from Madeleine Kuhnen to Howard Dean to Jim Douglas to Phil Scott, they all build their own apparatus to get themselves elected. And the party people are always saying, hey, can you throw a little of our way, help us raise money? And you know, that's the hard work of politics. And it's often easier for someone like Governor Scott or a Howard Dean to build their own brand.
Yeah. I mean, look, in the long run, I think that gubernatorial candidates that exist that way, governors that exist that way politically, do a real disservice to their down ballot coattails. And I think we see that Governor Scott's disconnect from the GOP has deep, the Vermont GOP has deep consequences for the quality of candidates that are, you know, coming up behind him. You know, when I ran the Democratic Party, Governor Shumlin did not sort of do that. He was really bought into the VBP as a whole. He was bought into our coordinated campaigns.
Yeah.
He was doing a lot of campaigning for down ballot candidates, and we were really successful. And, you know, I think a lot of the people that we see succeeding at statewide office now sort of like came up through an engaged connection to sort of a larger party building philosophy that Governor Shumlin had.
And so
he's not doing any favors for the Vermont GOP, that's for sure.
Well, that's right. Okay, lightning round. Sure. And I'm making this up as I go along. Bernie Sanders, does he – I mean, Bernie Sanders, I still don't think that people understand that he is the most recognized political name in America.
Oh, my God.
But – so question, does he run for reelection in 2024?
I mean, it's a good question. I don't – I think he does. I think he does. I think that Senator Sanders has public service built into his DNA. I can't see him stopping.
I agree. I agree. Peter Welch, does he serve one term? If he wins this election on Tuesday and becomes the next United States Senator, replacing the retiring Patrick Leahy, does he serve more than one term? Does he run again? It's just an age question, really.
I think that Congressman Welch is the same, has the same characteristics that Senator Leahy and Senator Sanders have. I think that public service and service to Vermont is built into their DNA. So we are objectively blessed that Congressman Welch is going to be in the U.S. Senate after next Tuesday. And, you know, if he chooses to do more than one term, we'll be lucky for it.
Does Becca Ballant, if elected, become a member of the squad, or does she straddle a more progressive approach combined with this is the way I see her, a more pragmatic approach? You know, she's the kind of person who can talk to everyone. And I doubt she isolates herself in the far left wing of the Democratic Party because that's not how she's built, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little longer answer than a lightning round. First thing I'm going to say is that I think that the moniker of the squad has been, like, grossly misunderstood because of its ascription. The squad really came together because we had a great cohort of extremely smart and talented women of color come into the freshman class in 2018, and they deserved the level of recognition that they have received. Has the squad in and of itself grown? No. Have progressives in Congress increased in the party? Yes, immensely. But being a member of the progressive left in the Democratic Party does not mean that you are disconnected or isolated from your constituency. There are few members of Congress that do more for their constituency and their district than Representative Ocasio-Cortez. From spearheading mutual aid efforts to being in her district constantly to having some of the most exceptional constituent services objectively of anybody in the House, those two things are not mutually exclusive. So when Becca goes to D.C., do I believe that she's going to be a very important component of the progressive left? I absolutely do. Do I think that that mitigates her ability to be a coalition builder and connect with people across the political spectrum? No, I don't. I think those two things exist together.
Yeah. Well, she's got an open invitation to come on this show. She has not been on yet. And I'm getting a little cranky about it. So if you're out there, Becca Ballant people, we'd love to have you anytime. Open invitation, as we have with Governor Scott. Julia Barnes, I really appreciate you coming on. And let's have you on again after the election to try to figure out what happened.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you. And we're coming up on the break. I promise, by the way, there's probably some out there saying, he's only having on the progressive political expert. I promise to have on a Republican expert from the other side. I'm looking for one. If you have any nominations, give me a call or send me an email at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And by the way, when we mention books on this show, which we do a lot, we're going to interview a lot of authors. Go get them at Bear Pond Books or Bridgeside Books in Waterbury. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. It's Kevin Ellis on WDEV. We're back. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. You're listening to WDEV, and our guest is the Democratic candidate for Secretary of State in Vermont, Sarah Copeland Hanzus. Welcome, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. And we're stay tuned, everybody, because we're going to have the Republican candidate on in the next half hour. So we talked a lot with Julia Barnes in the first hour about national politics and where things are going. Now we're going to get down to the local level. Sarah Copeland Hanzus grew up in Corinth, and she lives in Bradford. She graduated from Oxbow High School and UVM with degrees in history and geology. We'll get into that on another show. She and her husband have spent 8 years. Oh, she was a stay-at-home mom. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm reading this because what I really want to get to is she went to Oxbow High School and played basketball for the legendary Mona Garone.
That is correct.
And crossed paths with the even more famous George Huntington, both of those coaches, legendary in Vermont high school basketball annals, right?
Yeah, absolutely. George had open gym on Sunday nights, and he helped me hone my jump shot.
And his daughters, Jazz Huntington.
And Jade was in my class.
And Jade was in your class. We've only got a few minutes, so let's.
We could talk a long time about them.
Sarah has served 18 years in the Vermont legislature representing Bradford, Fairlie, and West Fairlie. And how many of those years as chair of the House Government Operations Committee?
The last 4 years.
And you are responsible for the current redistricting map of Vermont.
Yes. After the census, the district lines have to be redrawn so that we keep the population variation to a minimum. And that process we undertook last year in a completely condensed time frame because of the delay in the 2020 census data and then the fact that we needed to have that plan to the Secretary of State's office by April so that they could start to build districts for us to be able to vote in the August primary.
And you won the Democratic primary for Secretary of State. You are the Democratic candidate. Why run for this office?
So I have spent 18 years in the legislature listening to my neighbors, listening to Vermonters, asking them, you know, what's working, what's not working, and what can we do better? And when I think about the most visible role of the Secretary of State, that is the elections administrator for the state, I think there's a lot that we can learn from talking to Vermonters about how to encourage participation, how to encourage civic engagement, how to enable and inspire people to participate in democracy. Because if we don't strengthen our democracy and shore up our democracy, we're at risk of losing it.
Do you see any – we spent an hour talking about the national scene, and we even talked about the break-in at Speaker Pelosi's house. I mean, there's a lot of darkness in that conversation. Do you see any of that darkness or threats infiltrating the Vermont democracy?
I feel like there is the potential for that. You know, I want to hope and believe that because in Vermont we live in small communities and we cross paths with our town clerks who are our local elections administrators, you know, in the grocery store and you know, at the high school ball games. I want to believe that that can't take hold here. But we need to make sure that we don't take anything for granted at this moment because, you know, these local town clerks are really sort of the core to how democracy works here in Vermont, and none of them signed up for threats or home invasions or angry, you know, election deniers coming at them. And we should all be concerned about the potential for that.
So given that, why run for this office? Why put yourself out there? This is a question I'm asking more and more candidates.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's a lot. The pay is not that great. The hours are abominable.
Mm-hmm.
You get phone calls at the dinner table at night. Why do this public service?
You know, because it's that important. You know, it's important for somebody who's got 18 years of experience unraveling really complex and complicated issues, in doing it in a way that really requires you to go into the room of people who believe differently than you and sit down and talk with them. Mm. You know, that skill set is needed now more than ever. And, you know, I grew up in a household where not everybody around that dinner table believed in the same political philosophy. And so, you know, it feels very natural to me to sit down with folks who are maybe across the aisle from me, and talk through how do we reach common goals? How do we achieve them once we've agreed upon them?
You and I both lived, well, you are still living in Orange County.
That's correct.
I lived in Orange County for at least 15 years. That's not liberal Burlington. You just mentioned, you know, you sat at the dinner table. You've had political conversations across the spectrum your whole life.
Absolutely.
And that, how does that equip you to run for this office?
Well, it gives me the knowledge and the hope that there is a way to find common ground if we sit down and talk about the issues. I think what we worry about now is that there are certain factions who don't necessarily even want to sort of agree to the basic landscape as, you know, in terms of the prevalence of election deniers who latch on to different conspiracies. And so we really have to get out and talk with as many people as we can to open up the process, open up how government works so that people can see how we know. How do we know that our elections are safe? What are all the things that our local town clerks are doing every single day during this election season to ensure the security of our elections? There's a lot of people that really don't know a lot of those details.
It is interesting. I always love going into my town clerk's office because you know you're walking into a place where well, first of all, he or she is sitting right there at the desk, and you're like face to face with democracy.
Yeah.
And they know everything about your town.
Yeah.
How to register to vote, where to take your recycling, why the road crew hasn't put in on the pavement.
Whose dog keeps getting loose and running, you know, around the neighborhood.
They're amazing people. So tell us about the Secretary of State's office and what it does for Vermonters.
So there's four different divisions. There's the Corporations Division. We've got a great business portal that helps new businesses connect with other agencies of state government that they need in order to get started. I've spent a lot of time talking to people who've started businesses during the pandemic just because I wanted to get a chance to talk to people whose experience with this was fresh in their minds. We've got State Archives, which is really cool if you like to geek out on history. It's also really critical in terms of the transparency for Vermonters to have access to what their state government is doing on their behalf.
And most of those archives are in Middlesex.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And, you know, the all of the documents of Vermont's history are contained within our state archives and spend some time often in displays either at the Vermont History Center or in Montpelier at the Pavilion History Museum. So that's a lot of fun to be able to really see, you know, firsthand the history of the state of Vermont. And I think there's probably more that we can do in terms of helping Vermonters understand that wonderful treasure. We also run the Office of Professional Regulation, which licenses dozens and dozens of professions from, you know, your medical professionals like nurses and nurse practitioners and dentists all the way to sort of a vastly different end of the spectrum like amusement park operators and tattoo artists and whatnot. And then, of course, the Elections Division. So that is the one that tends to get the most attention, and I think the one that is most critical at this moment to really invest in.
including in an, I believe it's the Elections Division that regulates lobbyists.
That's correct.
Okay. And so I am no longer a registered lobbyist, but I used to be regulated by them with great pride, I must say, because I'd get a call every quarter or so saying,
have you filed?
Have you filed
your
disclosure?
Yes.
And if you don't, you're going to pay a $50 fine per day or something. So, okay, so four divisions. What are you going to – well, let's see. We've got 60 seconds before the break, so let's start the conversation. What are you going to – what do you if elected, what are you going to do? What are you going to change? What's your agenda?
Well, since we were just talking about lobbyist disclosure and campaign finance, I've got a sort of a 60-second piece there, but then we can talk more about how we strengthen democracy, which is hand-in-hand with this, but this is a smaller segment. So we have campaign finance laws that require candidates who raise or spend more than $500 to disclose that so that their constituents can see, you know, who's funding this campaign. It's not enforced right now because when the legislature asked, you know, a decade or so ago about enforcement, the Secretary of State's office said not me, the AG's office said not me, and so we have requirements but without consequences. We need to revisit that conversation with a new Attorney General and a new Secretary of State, but in the meantime, we need to, the Secretary of State's office needs to just simply send a reminder email. Hey, Kevin, you know, here's the link and your disclosure is due in 3 days.
Right.
That would take care of a lot of folks who simply forget.
Yeah. Good. Okay. We've got a caller on the line for Sarah, and it's Brian from Eden. Brian, you're on the line. How you doing?
Hey, good. It's a beautiful morning. I was kind of in and out. Once again, I caught part of it. Was there an educational responsibility with the Secretary of State? Is that like archives and...
Oh, we
are you there?
Yeah, keep going, Brian. Educational components of the archives.
I was just curious if it was because Ms. Hansen had me a geologist, and it is just such a great focus for Vermont history. You could go back 450 million years up at Isle Lamont. You could go down to Rock of Ages and watch them quarrying today, and the link between the geological history of Vermont and the social history is just fabulous. I mean. So it's not a real political question. As far as politics go, we have really fair and free elections. Anything that can be done to keep them that way is appreciated.
Great. Thanks for the call.
So, yeah, Brian, I really appreciate the highlighting of the connection between Vermont's geology and the way humans have settled our state. You know, the reason why agriculture is more prevalent in Vermont than it is in our neighboring state of New Hampshire is really all about the geology. It's about the soils that have broken down from metamorphic rocks instead of the more acidic, you know, granite domes that you see over in New Hampshire. So our history and our geology or geologic history are pretty well intertwined.
Vermont's is better, though. Our rocks are better.
Oh, yeah. Our rocks are better. Our soil is better. Yes, absolutely.
Before the break, we started talking about what you, if elected, what your plans for the Office of Secretary of State are. So why don't you keep going?
Yeah, so I think it's really important for us, as I've said before, to invest in democracy. Under Jim Condos, we've made a lot of pro-voter reforms. He has brought to the legislature a lot of ideas about how to make it easier to register to vote, you know, same-day voter registration so that if you moved or if you forgot to register, there isn't some sort of arbitrary deadline that passes and says, sorry, you can't vote. And then universal vote by mail, which really is a pro-voter reform. But now that you get your ballot 45 days ahead of the general election, I think the Secretary of State's office also ought to create a voter guide. Many states that do universal vote by mail create a voter guide. And most of this information is information that the Secretary of State's office already collects about candidates, your name, your address, your phone number, your website if you have one, your social media handles. And then we can also ask candidates to, you know, give us 100 words. Why are you running for this office? What will you do if elected? Compile all that into a website. Also give people the opportunity to order a paper copy in case they don't have good internet service. And, you know, give people the opportunity to use that 45 days to really find the candidate whose values most closely match their own. I think that'll be very empowering for democracy. And then we also have to recognize that in order for people to feel able to participate, they need to understand more about how government works. You know, it used to be that there was a civics class. Every kid who graduated from high school had, you know, your basic how to be a citizen class. And yeah. that doesn't necessarily happen anymore. There are some communities that continue to have a good civics program, and others that, you know, sort of sprinkle in a bit of how to participate in democracy, but they don't have that concentrated lesson. I want to hire an education outreach coordinator to bring together a group of teachers from pre-K all the way through high school and help advise us on how we can create curriculum material for teachers that will be easy for them to bring into their classroom, so that if they don't already have a dedicated civics class, that they can incorporate these lessons as they go along. You know, when I talk to my young adult children, you know, I'm getting this real sense between the pandemic and the global war on terror that and climate change, that kids are really unsettled. They're no longer sure that they will be able to live, you know, kind of the basic lifestyle that their parents did because of student debt, because of worries about climate change and et cetera, et cetera. We need young people to feel empowered, to step up and start drawing attention to some of these challenges that are barriers to their, you know, health and happiness going forward.
They're also losing, I think, confidence in the institutions of government.
Yes.
And there's a lot of blame to go around for that, but I think the result of such a loss of confidence in institutions, like the Secretary of State's office, like the town clerk, is really bad.
Yes.
And we need to work to restore that.
Yeah. And I think that young people don't understand how powerful their voices are if they band together and demand from their government what the kind of action that they're yearning for.
In my political advocacy days, we used to tell clients that 5 phone calls to a legislator
is a landslide.
Is a landslide.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It matters.
It does.
As we said with Julie Barnes in the previous hour, a candidate will come to your door. You can actually meet them at on the green at the farmer's market, at a ball game or whatever.
Right.
And they will talk to you. The governor will say hello to you when he's on his way downtown to get a sandwich.
Yeah.
And that is the redeeming quality of this democracy in Vermont.
That's what gives me hope that of any place in this country, Vermont can strengthen its democracy.
The Secretary of State's office is in downtown Montpelier, right?
Yes, it is.
So you'll be quite a visible figure if elected.
Yeah, and I don't want to stay just in Montpelier. You know, some of the fun of being on the campaign trail has really been about getting out into communities, stopping in at the local municipal offices, talking to the clerks and the listers and the select board members. You know, I want to be out and about Vermont as well, talking to school kids, talking to local government officials, and, you know, asking the same questions that I've been asking for 18 years. What's working? What's not working? What can we do better? It's as simple as that.
What have you, in your travels on the campaign trail, what have you heard about people's, what do they care about?
Well, of course, affordable housing is a big challenge right now, as is childcare. Those are the two big barriers that people are having to, employers are finding to being able to hire someone. Sorry, I can't. You know, can't come in today because my kid's daycare is closed. Or I would love to accept this job, but I can't find a place within my budget to live, you know, within a reasonable drive to this. And so, you know, people are talking about these economic issues, but they're also concerned about democracy. when you look at what happened on January 6th, when you look at what happened just last week at the Pelosi residence in San Francisco, people are worried about our institutions, and they really like the idea of doubling down on civics, of making information more available to voters through a voter guide as ways of strengthening our democracy.
So it's now Wednesday. You've got 6 days to go.
Woohoo!
This is your first run for statewide office. What do you do as a candidate between now and Tuesday?
So
literally from the minute you wake up, like, do you have time for breakfast and a cup of coffee, or are you out at 6 a.m.?
I really wish that I had a bit more of a relaxed schedule, but I'm going to keep going hard right through the finish line, you know, run through the tape, as they say. You know, at this point, it's about reminding people who haven't yet turned in their ballot to do that, and reminding them that they've heard my name, that they have looked at my legislative record, that they appreciate the issues that I've worked on. And so I'm still getting out doing visibility events. There will be some honking waves, I'm sure. You know, I have an 18-year string of standing outside on Election Day greeting voters. And so now that I'm running statewide, I can do that sort of.
Where will you be? Do you have your schedule for Election Day?
I don't have a schedule yet. Okay. I think I'm basically going to make a meandering drive, stopping off at polling places between here and Burlington, because the big statewide election night watch party is in Burlington.
So we'll be able to see – voters will be able to see you visibly somewhere, somehow.
And if they have a thought or a question or an idea, I welcome them to come right up and talk to me.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. It's a serious issue for serious people. Sarah Copeland-Hanzus is the Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. By the way, we are going to have the sitting Secretary of State, Jim Condos, on the show on Friday to kind of get us ready for the election and what we need to know and what we don't need to know. Sarah Copeland-Hanzus, thank you very much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. Our next, we're going to have her opponent, the Republican, H. Brooke Page, on the show just after the break. So you are listening to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis, your host, and you're listening to WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back. I'm Kevin Ellis, your host. We're talking about the elections. We're talking about democracy, and we're talking about government. And our guest is H. Brooke Page, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State. We had his opponent, the Democrat, Sarah Copeland-Hanzus, on just beforehand. And we've got an opportunity to talk about the guts of democracy with Mr. Page, because he is also the Republican candidate for state treasurer. Are you the Republican candidate for any other offices, Mr. Page? Welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here with you, Kevin. I actually am. In the town of Washington, I'm also running for Justice of the Peace, as I have done in the past.
A more important office, I might add.
A more localized and high-profile office.
Full disclosure, I was a resident of Washington for 11 years probably, and I was the chair of the zoning board.
Very good.
Yeah. It was the worst job I've ever had in my life. Oh, my God. It's as bad as school board.
Oh, I think school board is probably worse.
Okay, so you're a Republican, so you have to – answer the requisite Republican question. Is Joe Biden the duly elected president of the United States?
I am convinced that if I went down to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, knocked on the door and asked whoever answered the door who's residing inside, they would say Joe Biden.
Is he the properly elected president of the United States? Was the election properly conducted? And is he the winner as the Electoral College certified and as more than 60 lawsuits tell us after the election?
Well, clearly he was the winner of the Electoral College, and that is the only standard that exists. You know, when you talk about lawsuits are an interesting thing. If you look at all of these lawsuits, many of them never make it to fruition. And, you know, the courts are loath to get involved in political questions. So the success or failure of a lawsuit.
Well, they got involved in the Bush v. Gore election.
Oh, of course they did. And you know, this is interesting when you talk about – everyone wants to talk about election deniers, right? Well, the proponents of Mr. Gore were election deniers. The proponents of Mr. Kerry were election deniers.
They accepted the result, though. Gore made a speech on, when the court made its decision saying, I don't agree with it, but I accept it.
Yeah. But clearly Mrs. Clinton never accepted it. To this day, she's out, you know, saying, well, Donald Trump wasn't truly elected candidate. And so there's been.
That's not true. That's not true. She says I got more votes than he did in the popular vote, which is true.
Yeah.
But she accepted her loss.
Well,
Donald Trump hasn't accepted his loss.
I don't want to burn up time on this, but I've heard her many times say otherwise.
Are you an election denier or not?
No, I believe that the count was more or less accurate. Okay, I think that Mr. Trump's biggest failing was in not challenging all the same year election changes that were being made in many states, by example, Pennsylvania. And because they let those things go through and didn't go to court at that time,
right,
post-election court actions just were doomed to failure. Other things that influenced the election maybe unfairly was obviously the press had their thumb heavily on the Biden side of the equation. I think that the riots throughout 2020 sent a clear message to many that if Mr. Trump was reelected, the chaos would continue. And I think now, after the fact, we're finding out that the FBI was involved not only in the 2020 election, but in the 2016 election, as they appear to have been behind the Russia hoax scandal, as well as suppressing the Hunter Biden laptop issue. And we now find out that I think it's 8% of all of the Biden voters say that they would have been influenced by understanding that all of the mischief that was on the Hunter Biden laptop was in fact true. So in all of this in the mix, was the election fair? Maybe. Was the count fair? Most probably. And that doesn't give you the answer you want, but
no,
it's the answer I have.
No, that's a great answer. So that makes you that's a full embrace of the Trump conspiracy theory that the election was somehow rigged, the media's in the tank for the Democrats, etc.
Matter of fact, in the years before Mr. Trump's political capital became great, back when I was running against Mr. Shumlin in 14, I actually wrote a piece called Character Matters, Even If You're the Governor. And in that piece, it's archived on Vermont Digger's website, I actually compared Mr. Shumlin and Mr. Trump, and not in a very flattering way. And so I was never really a Trump devotee.
You weren't?
No, absolutely not.
Did you vote for him?
In the end, I voted for the lesser of the two weasels. both in 16 and in 20.
Wait, which was who?
Well, I did not vote for Mrs. Clinton, and I did not vote for Mr. Biden. Matter of fact, the first time I didn't vote for Mr. Biden was in 1972, the first time I was allowed to vote. I was a student at the University of Delaware. I lived in Delaware at the time, and this young rascal who was on the board of the county board for Newcastle County, Delaware, decided he was going to run against the very prestigious Caleb Boggs.
Correct.
And Caleb Boggs had been senator for, I think, two terms. He had been in the House of Representatives representing Delaware. He had been governor for several terms. He had been Delaware's equivalent of attorney general and had sat in their own House of Representatives, which has a different name that's not coming to me right now. And Caleb was kind of coaxed into running one more time because the Republicans really didn't have any strong person to replace him. And Mr. Biden went out, was very dismissive and parochial about his opinions of Caleb Boggs, and squeaked out a victory. Remember that
at 29 years old.
At 29 years old, did not become legally of age until just before he took office. And so Mr. Biden and I have a long and storied relationship, at least in the voting booth. And we could burn up an hour talking about that, but we
cannot. So you're the Republican candidate for Secretary of State.
Yes.
Are you placing and state treasurer,
yes.
Do you place more emphasis on one office or the other in terms of your campaigning?
I'm more versed in the issues at the Secretary of State's office. The treasurer's office, understand, I'm not highly qualified, credentialed for that office. And if I were to be so fortunate to be elected, I would probably in very short order, after having taken office, consult with the governor about other folks who I think that are far more highly qualified, some of whom could not run on the Republican ticket because of the Hatch Act. And there's one person that I would love to see become treasurer who happens to be a Democrat from downstate, and I won't mention her name, but most people know from my out campaigning who I'm talking about. And she's highly credentialed. I revealed her sexual identity, at least. I chatted with her, and she was astonished that I would, think to do that. But understand, my problem is that right now, and this assumes that Doug Hoffer wins again. Okay,
the state auditor of accounts, yeah,
who is a self-proclaimed progressive and maybe a little bit of a Democrat. You have the Mike Pichak, my opponent for treasurer, if he would be elected, he identifies as a progressive Democrat, and we have a overwhelmingly progressive Democratic supermajority legislature. Who's yep. minding the hen house? Who's looking out for the people of Vermont and the taxpayers of Vermont? We need to mix up the basket a little bit so we have some, inquiring eyes looking at these different functions of government. And that's what I hope to achieve by winning for treasurer and then having the governor in consultation with the now serving treasurer to find the most qualified person to run that office. We have a lot of troubles. Beth Pierce is a wonderful lady, but she has not done a yeoman's job as far as overseeing the state pension fund. She has not had a critical eye towards the legislature as they come up with budget after budget. And so, and enough about the treasurer's office. I think that points out.
Well, let's get to Secretary of State after this. Let's take a break.
Very good.
And we'll come back after the break. We're here with H. Brooke Page, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State and State Treasurer and Justice of the Peace.
In the town of Washington, Vermont.
In the town of Washington, Vermont. It's Kevin Ellis. You're listening to WDEV. We're back. It's Kevin Ellis. I'm your host. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. We got just a few minutes left with Brooke Page, who is the Republican candidate for Secretary of State, the Swiss Army knife of Vermont politics. You have run for Attorney General, Governor, U.S. Senator, U.S. House, Treasurer, Secretary of State, Attorney General. You just told me that the one office you have not run for is Lieutenant Governor.
That's correct. I was actually on the ballot, but Don Turner in 2018, I guess, stepped up at the last minute, and I immediately withdrew. I had actually petitioned for that office as well and immediately withdrew before the primary so Don would have a clear shot.
Do you run for these offices out of a sense of duty to representative democracy, or you do it because you're a dyed-in-the-wool Republican who has a cause to fight for, or both?
I guess split it down the middle that, I think that no one should be in a coronation for an office. And many times if I had not done this, there would be no challenger to the Democrat who was running on the ballot. And that would certainly be a sad and embarrassing situation for the state. So I've done this in order to prevent the Democrats from using the open primary process to exclude the Republican Party from having an opportunity to have a Republican on the general election ballot.
We have a call.
Go for it.
We take your calls and we welcome your calls. Please call 244-1777 if you want to get on the line with me or Brooke Page. John from Washington, you're on the line.
Hey, Brooke, this is John from Washington. Hey, so I heard the lady that was running against you, when she first came on, she was talking about how she wanted to regulate what we said on the internet in disinformation and that there should be actual consequences for that. What's your opinion on our First Amendment?
I did not hear that segment of her discussion, but I find that rather troubling, to say the least. I think that we should have a free and open discussion of all of the issues, and I think it's up to the citizens and the voters to sugar it all out. We hear many absurd things from both sides of the schoolyard, if you like, and for someone to have their thumb on the scale for one side or the other, it shouldn't be the function of government. If you're shouting, fire in a open theater, that's a different issue. But as far as judging the credibility of various statements, that's up to the voters and the citizens to decide.
And where's that line for you? So does that include hate speech on Twitter, people using the N-word, for instance? How far do we go here? Thanks for the call, by the way, John.
I think that, rude and offensive remarks, act to label and portray the person making them. We talk about the N-word, yet in black culture, it's regularly shouted out in musicals and, whatever. I think that Caucasian liberals become more triggered and offended by it than true members of the black community.
Sheila from Barrytown, you are on the line with H. Brooke Page.
Wow, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Page, in order to make Vermont's elections more secure, can you speak to your ideas about voter ID, signature verification, and anything else that you'd like to see installed?
I certainly can. The current system that we've just employed of universal vote by mail, where we're just mailing vote ballots out to everybody that's on the various lists, including, I might point out, 8,900 people that are known to have died that are still on the voter checklist and wound up getting ballots. I think that I had suggested in court that until we had either voter ID and or up-to-date voter checklist with signature verification, that the ballot should have been sent out by certified mail. So we had a chain of custody that in that case, the printer that condos hired to send out the ballots would have turned those over to the post office. The post office would have been required to deliver them and get a signature from the intended recipient. And then at that point, the recipient would have been able to mail the ballots back. But we have – the ballots are coming back in, and we have no idea who's really filled the ballots out. Now, we hope that most all of them were filled out by the intended individual. In my town of Washington, we got a nice thick stack of about 50 of them came back, and some of them are very interesting. Some of them were – many of them said, no such person at this address. A couple of them came back with the words scrawled on it, she or he has Alzheimer's and can't vote anymore. And, you know, I mean, these are the honest folks sending them back. How many ballots wound up in the hands of the less honest? And that's a real problem. You know, the entire, you know, what I call Jim Condos' elections gone wild, where we're just mailing ballots out across the countryside, is a dangerous situation. Not so much because it might influence the outcome. Realize the legal requirement is, did the errors, omissions, and fraud, was it sufficient to change the outcome of the election? What I think is the bigger concern is the perception of errors, omission, and fraud that many voters have. And I would estimate a good 10 to 15% of qualified Vermont voters are no longer participating in the process because they believe the whole thing is rigged or something's nefarious going on, and they've given up. Well, 10 to 15% of all the qualified voters in the state is more than a sufficient number to change the outcome of many of the elections here in Vermont.
Sheila, thanks for the call. We will have Secretary of State Jim Condos on the show on Friday to answer that question. I hope you'll call in and ask it because 10 to 15%? Say that again.
10 to 15%. It's my reading. Understand, I go out and get all my petitions signed myself.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed at the number of people I'm asking who I think are good, you know, citizens, you know, voting all about democracy. And they say, I'm not even registered anymore. I've given up.
I see.
And that's, you know, I don't think anybody's ever done a statistical analysis.
Right.
But there it is. And certainly if it was 5%, it would be significant enough.
Let's take one more call. Fred from Newberry, welcome back. You waited till the second hour of the show. I'm surprised. You're on the line.
Yeah, I know. I was tied up. Hey, look, this hate speech is very dangerous. I'm worried about it. I want to know if you guys have a list of hate phrases that I'm not allowed to say so I don't, you know, get in trouble.
Go to Twitter jail or Facebook jail there because of it. My thing is I think more speech is always better. I think that people can sugar out, you know, what is offensive and attach that label to the people making the offensive speech. And they doom themselves by doing so.
And yet, in a social media environment where conspiracy theorists and crazy people are breaking into the house of the Speaker of the House in San Francisco, threatening to break her kneecaps, and the January 6th riot, doesn't that change the equation a little bit?
You know,
they were going to kill her. They were going to kill the Vice President of the United States, the Republican Mike Pence. They would have killed him.
So they said.
You
know, and my thing is, you know, that who fomented all of this? Was it Donald Trump or was it others who had nefarious intent? I do not know.
Well, there's certainly no evidence that others had nefarious intent. Are you talking about like Democrats?
I do not know.
This is the Antifa side of the
No. I don't know. My biggest thing is that I think that January 6th has not been put into context with the Puerto Rican intrusion into the Capitol building or, you know, other significant things that have happened. It's on the same scale, but many on the Democratic side have made it seem like it was so much more overwhelmingly dangerous.
Well, we'll have to bring you back for another half hour to talk about that one. That's our show for today. You can find me on Twitter at Ellis52K, where I discuss many of these same issues, or on my blog at KevinKEllis.com. I'll be back on Friday with Jim Condos, the Secretary of State. Thanks to our guests today, including H. Brooke Page. We'll see you on Friday. You're listening to WDEV.
Very good.